Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2022 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvineawards.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in California's decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, the forgotten history of a farm labor crisis during World War II. And from StoryCorps San Joaquin, a male impersonator looks back on her years as an entertainer. But first, vaccines have been open to everyone 16 years and older in Fresno County for a month now. With demand for the vaccine declining in the county, FM89's Mari Bolaños went to the Cherry Auction, a swap meet and cultural hub of the Latino community, to see what stops some Latino residents from getting the vaccine.
It's a warm Saturday morning in South Fresno County. The song Carta Jugada by Banda Tuzantla plays as families and vendors bargain at the Cherry Auction. It's the Central Valley's largest outdoor market with endless rows of vendors. Latino residents have come here for decades to purchase clothing, blankets, produce, and much more. The music is coming from 27-year-old Alejandro Gonzalez's CD stand. Gonzalez and his family have sold CDs here since he was 8 years old.
It officially became mine when I was 15. My dad passed away and I took over the stand.
He says selling CDs is a dying business. He's even considered an exit plan a few times, especially during the pandemic. The Cherry Auction never fully closed in the past year, but he says there were a few moments where hardly anyone showed up.
There was weeks that were really tough.
He has other jobs during the week, but he relies on their sales at the swap meet to make some extra cash to support his family. But with COVID cases declining in the San Joaquin Valley and vaccines becoming more available, things are looking up, he says.
Now that it's opening up, I can tell that people are excited to buy, people want to come and buy.
But for the county to safely reopen, public health officials need to convince more people to get vaccinated. A recent poll from the Public Policy Institute of California finds that 20% of people in the Central Valley won't get the vaccine. It finds the region has the highest rate of vaccine hesitancy in the state. In Fresno County, Latinos are the majority of the population, but they only make up about 36% of people who have received at least one dose of the vaccine. Gonzalez says for him, getting the vaccine was about protecting his family.
My mom, well, obviously she's a little bit older, and I want to make sure she didn't get sick. And at the same time, I have a sister that's pretty sick, and I want to make sure that I put myself in a position where I don't pass that over to them.
His wife sells small toys a few aisles down, and his mom sells perfumes and colognes at a stand next to him. Gonzalez says his mom was hesitant to get the vaccine because of what she had heard from Spanish news outlets and social media sites like Facebook.
After speaking with her directly, she understood logically it's reasonable to get a vaccine. Like in everything we consume in our body, there's always risk.
She got the vaccine, but others at the swap meet are still hesitant. Marla Gonzalez is here with her husband and two kids. She came to the swap meet to purchase a faja, or waist trainer, used by some women to give the illusion of a smaller waist. She says she doesn't have plans to get the vaccine anytime soon, especially after hearing that health officials briefly paused the use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine last month, following reports that six women who got the shot developed blood clots.
Because a lot of people still haven't taken it either. And well, also with the news of them passing the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
She hadn't heard that the CDC had allowed the Johnson & Johnson vaccine to be administered again and admitted she doesn't pay much attention to the news. When she does, she says she doesn't hear good things about the vaccine.
In Univision, that people have died from the vaccine or that they had strong reactions to the vaccine.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention currently say there are no deaths directly attributed to COVID-19 vaccines. Gonzalez says she might take it if it becomes a requirement at work. 32-year-old Ana Saucedo is here with her three kids. She says she contracted COVID while working at a distribution warehouse in Fresno. She says the company was incentivizing people to work more hours back in December.
They were doing like this $1,000 bonus if we stayed at work for 10 days for 10 hours. So people didn't want to miss on that. So they were coming to work sick.
That experience convinced her to get the vaccine, but her husband is still not ready.
He just doesn't want to feel the symptoms. He thinks he'll like instantly feel symptoms receiving the vaccine.
Saucedo's parents are also hesitant about getting the vaccine, but for other reasons, she says.
My mom just says that she thinks they're just testing it on people right now.
On the other side of the swap meet, 45-year-old Rafael Cisneros is making balloon animals for kids in exchange for tips. He's a roofer, but he learned balloon art in 2008 when the recession hit and home construction ground to a halt. It's come in handy again during the pandemic, he says.
I make about $60 because the balloons come out to $12 a bag, and I bring about 5 bags, plus the space I pay for here, which is about $28, plus gas, and I bring my kids, and sometimes they want something to eat.
His four boys watch him from the shade as he makes swords and flower balloons for other kids. Cisneros says he's ready for the pandemic to be over so he can return to working on roofs full time. But he's still not sure about getting the vaccine.
I've heard that it gives you blood clots, and that's why people don't want to take it. That's why I'm waiting, because if I get it and that happens to my blood, then I have my kids, and well, what am I going to do?
Like others, he says he isn't completely ruling out the vaccine. He just needs more time. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Mari Bolaños.
This story is part of the Central Valley News Collaborative, which is supported by the Central Valley Community Foundation with technology and training support by Microsoft Corporation. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. It is increasingly likely that Governor Gavin Newsom will face a recall election later this year. What is less clear is when it will happen, how much it will cost, and what it will mean for the political future of the governor and those running to replace him. To discuss these questions and more, I spoke with Ivy Cargyle, assistant professor of political science at CSU Bakersfield, along with political reporters Ben Christopher at CalMatters and Nicole Nixon at Cap Radio. So the recall petition was introduced early in 2020, and the reason stated for the recall had nothing to do with the pandemic. However, I don't think there's any question that public frustration over Newsom's pandemic response drove signature collection. So I think my first question is, and Nicole, we'll start with you, to what extent do you see this recall as an anomaly, or is this perhaps what will become politics as usual moving forward?
I think just, you know, based on the past year, I think it would be fair to call it an anomaly for a few reasons. First, like you mentioned, the pandemic and all of the restrictions that have been, you know, got mixed response. People did hate them, obviously, but Newsom's gotten pretty good feedback via polling on his pandemic restrictions. A couple other things, though. The recall organizers went to a judge and asked for more time because of the pandemic. They kind of timed this recall effort so that they could use the summer going to in-person events, festivals, state and county fairs, those kinds of things to gather signatures. But because of stay-at-home orders, they couldn't do that. So they asked a judge for more time, and they got it. That ruling came down around the same time that Newsom went to the French Laundry in Napa Wine Country and upset a lot of people by going to this fancy dinner while he was telling people to stay home. And the recall signature drive really exploded after that. So definitely all of those things added up to get this recall where it is now, which is, you know, on its way to very likely go before voters later this year.
Ivy Cargyle, given your perspective as a political scientist, do you agree with Nicole's assessment?
I do. I think that she hit it spot on. You know, the stay-at-home orders that the governor ordered really flew in the face of what he did in terms of going to that restaurant for that dinner with that lobbyist. I think that really angered people. And I think people are just also just frustrated with the situation. Not that, you know, that the governor can control the pandemic or anything like that. I mean, there's only so much he can do is what I'm trying to say, right? So I think that, you know, the stay-at-home orders and people's frustration with their economic situation really did boil over to what was just said.
Ben Christopher, you've been covering this recall for CalMatters. I'd love for you to get into the timeline. Now, I appreciate the fact that it's complicated, but when might this vote actually occur?
So right now, I think the best guess is probably November or sometime towards the end of the year. There are a number of sort of procedural hoops that we still have to jump through. As we know, or as the recall proponents were able to gather enough signatures and submit them to the various counties, which in turn submitted them to the Secretary of State, which just signed off, making it all but official. But we still have another few weeks in which recall proponents are given the opportunity to take off their names, to sort of unsign their support for the recall if they so choose. And then after that, then there's going to be a fiscal assessment, and then there's going to be a 60 days in which the lieutenant governor can then call the race. So there are a number of sort of questions about sort of the timing, but it does look like probably towards the end of the year is when this is all going to happen. And so for folks who are kind of bemused by, you know, seeing John Cox with a bear and Caitlyn Jenner showing up on Fox News, and this is probably a good preview of what the next, 5 or 6 months of California political life are going to look like.
Well, you know what? Let's talk about the bear. Ivy Cargill, you know, it filled my Twitter feed, right? John Cox with this live bear announcing his candidacy. I mean, obviously it's a stunt, but we're talking about the bear. So, I mean, I guess the question is, how likely is this recall expected to be successful? I mean, especially given California's demographics and Newsom's past support. We'll start with Ivy and then we'll go to Nicole.
So I think that's you hit the nail on the head in regards to the success of the recall, is that there, you know, since the last one that we had in 2003, there have been a lot of different shifts that have happened in California. The Republican Party is no longer the second largest party in the state, aside from the fact that, you know, also the demographics of the state have changed in regards to there not being one racial ethnic group that predominates in terms of population size over any other. So I think that those two things, I think, are key drivers in regards to the fact that this recall might end up differently than the 2003 recall. Additionally, I think what we also need to pay attention to is the fact that while people are frustrated with the pandemic and people to some degree are frustrated with Governor Newsom, he's still polling above 50%, whereas around this time, Gray Davis's numbers were much lower than Newsom's are. So there's a couple of, I think these are a couple of different elements that are allowing this recall to be a little, just to be different to what happened in 2003. And they are significant differences that are going to, I think, make the recall possibly not succeed.
Nicole Nixon, you're covering this for Cap Radio. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I completely agree with Ivy. You know, Democrats are a much larger force in California nowadays than they were in 2003. And Newsom's polling numbers also look much better. A couple other things, though, is that Newsom is able to point to progress being made on the pandemic. You know, when they were gathering signatures in force over the winter, we were in another round of stay-at-home orders. There were huge amounts of cases and deaths daily. And here we're in the midst of, you know, reopening and loosening restrictions and have this plan to end many of those restrictions in the middle of June. So if that keeps up, it will just be good for Newsom to be able to campaign on that.
Thinking back to our sort of earlier on in the conversation when we were talking about whether this is an anomaly or not, and certainly it is in the sense that no one saw the pandemic coming, including the proponents of the recall themselves. But I guess it's kind of happening within this broader context of California politics, which is that Republicans haven't won statewide since 2006, and they've had some luck with the recall mechanism, whether it's at the state level. Obviously, the last time they won a gubernatorial race was via the recall with Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, and also at the sort of the more local or legislative level in 2018, Republicans were able to take back a state Senate seat that they lost in 2016 via the recall. They lost again in 2020. But I guess all that is to say that in recall elections, which tend to be a little bit lower turnout and where the folks hoping to recall the person in the office have a lot of the enthusiasm, it's sort of a tempting mechanism for the party, the Republican Party. And so while this is definitely an unusual circumstance this year and in this last year, I wouldn't be surprised if the recall becomes just a more and more common display that we see in California politics.
Okay, but even if Newsom isn't recalled, this is still going to have consequences for the state. Can you talk about, let's just start, I guess, with the fiscal consequences. Ben Christopher, based on your reporting, how much is this going to cost taxpayers?
Yeah, so I've seen a fairly large range of estimates, ranging from something like $70 million to the hundreds of millions. So we don't know for sure yet, but and there will be a fiscal report coming out later this year from the state that will be a little bit more official. But certainly it's going to cost a lot of money. Elections are not cheap, and particularly this year where everyone, once again, is going to be getting a ballot in the mail. It makes things a little bit more complicated. And so there is that fiscal dimension. And in fact, you've seen that in the messaging from some folks. Last weekend, there was the California Democratic Party convention, and Betty Yee, the state controller, came out and really focused on how this is just going to be a waste of taxpayer money in her view. Of course, that ship has sailed in the sense that this recall is happening whether we want it or not. And so those funds are going to have to be spent.
Ivy Cargill, what are your thoughts about consequences fiscally or legislatively? I mean, will this recall affect Newsom's legislative agenda in any way?
To the fiscal part of it, right, I think Ben is right in that it's going to be expensive, no doubt. And it's going to be expensive. And then it's also going to kind of fly in the face of the fact that Newsom actually goes up for re-election again in 2022, right? So it's like we're going to be spending all of this money, given how hard hit the state has been because of the pandemic, just like the rest of the country. So I think that, you know, obviously there's going to be fiscal damage done. And in regards to the political agenda per se for Newsom, I don't necessarily see, if he survives the recall, he will have to be careful. But to a point that Nicole made earlier, you know, he's going to be campaigning for this recall at a time where the state is going to be opening up. Last time I checked, in comparison to other states, California is handling the numbers are staying steady, and they're staying low in regards to COVID cases confirmed and also in regards to deaths. So he will be able to tout that as, you know, a somewhat successful handling, for lack of a better term, of the pandemic. And so he will have to then again, you know, campaign on that again for re-election in 2022 if he survives the recall. So I think he will have to, maybe his agenda won't be as ambitious as he initially maybe perceived it, but he still will be able to get some things done. A report by the Public Policy Institute of California in March shows that as of right now, right, both the legislature and him, you know, him being a Democrat, the legislature being majority Democrat, have positive ratings. They're above 50% in terms of, you know, people being or Californians, I should say, being happy with the job that they're doing. So perhaps the agenda won't be the legislative agenda that he originally foresaw. It isn't going to be as grandiose as he wants it to be. But he'll still be able to get something done because, you know, he'll have a little wind in his sails given that if he survives the recall.
I do want to talk a bit about the candidates. And Nicole, I'm going to direct this next question to you. You know, when we were looking at headlines, Caitlyn Jenner is generating her fair share. And, you know, traditionally a reality TV star and a political outsider candidate wouldn't be taken seriously, but we are living in different times. And so I'm wondering, just how seriously are you taking, we'll just start with her candidacy, but really there's going to be a lot of candidates that are sort of seen as these outsiders or these fringe candidates. I mean, what is in it for them to get into this race?
publicity, at least for a lot of, you know, these more fringe candidates. We saw that last time with an adult film star and, you know, 134 other people campaigning to replace Gray Davis at that time. With Caitlyn Jenner, you know, she's made the case that she genuinely is concerned about the future of the state and, much like the message of Donald Trump, wants to take it back to sort of the good times of before, you know, when taxes were lower and all of those kinds of things. Caitlyn Jenner, though, has not had campaign appearances, you know, for local media. She was on Sean Hannity this week with her first sort of campaign interview, and she's has received some a criticism from, you know, political observers here in California that it seems like she's going for this national attention. Whereas, you know, with candidates like John Cox, he did launch his campaign had his first campaign stop around the state this week with that bear. It also ended up getting national attention.
People can't stop talking about the bear.
And just what we're seeing this week, I think it does, like Ben mentioned, set the stage for, you know, the next 5-6 months of crazy political stunts. And I guess we'll just see who else, you know, enters the foray into this.
Yeah. Ben Christopher, do you see any of these candidates being, maybe if not serious contenders in the recall election, serious contenders if it fails when Governor Newsom goes up for reelection?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question, because I could kind of see it going one of two ways, which is one, if Gavin Newsom is able to fend this off, particularly if he's able to do so by a wide margin, perhaps that will discredit some of these attempts, and voters in 2022, particularly if it's a larger electorate, will kind of look at some of these folks and say, well, didn't we already do this in 2021? On the other hand, it is an opportunity to sort of get your name out there and do sort of a test run. So even if the recall isn't successful, more voters will have heard of people like Kevin Faulkner, the former mayor of San Diego, who is running and has raised a fair amount of money. I would say the same thing about John Cox, but of course, John Cox already did run for governor in 2018 and lost by a historically large margin. So unclear. I mean, I think the big question hanging over all of this is whether a Democrat gets into the race, because at this point, it's really Newsom versus a handful of Republicans. And if that's the case, if that's the dynamic, that's pretty good news for Newsom in a state where Democratic voters outnumber Republican voters about 2-1. If a Democrat gets in, as one did with Cruz Bustamante in 2003, who was then Lieutenant Governor to Gray Davis as governor, that could really shake up the race in a more dramatic way. But given Newsom's high approval numbers and given the display that we saw at the California Democratic Party convention over the weekend, in which there was really sort of this unified front, no risk of that just yet, but, you know, 5 or 6 months, that's a long time in politics.
Yeah, Ivy Cargill, what are your thoughts about a Democrat getting in this race? I mean, what's the political calculus there?
I completely agree with Ben that if a Democrat decides to get into the race, depending on who the Democrat is and how much name recognition the individual has, that can shake up the race. Now, I'm not saying even if the person doesn't have name recognition, it's not necessarily the case that they can't get it and build it, you know, within the time frame that we have, right, between the time that somebody announces and the time that the election happens. So that can really have an effect. But given this past weekend with the California Democratic Convention, it seems like Democrats are in line in terms of making sure that, you know, Newsom stays on as governor and making sure that this recall is unsuccessful. So, you know, we don't know what people are thinking, right? So it's hard to say. But my assumption is that national Democrats and the state Democrats have been really good about making sure the messaging and making sure that no one steps into the ring and then, you know, allows for Newsom to just face a handful of Republicans during the recall, which then allows him, you know, it makes the prospects look better for Newsom to stay on as governor.
Right. And that framing of making this a party, you know, the GOP is coming after Newsom, certainly benefits Newsom in this recall. Isn't that right, Nicole?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's
his main campaign message against this is that it's being pushed by, you know, the national GOP and political extremists, and that it just is kind of serving as a distraction from his efforts to get the economy fully reopened and get millions more vaccines into people's arms. And also that it's a waste of taxpayer money. So that is a message that he can continue to use for the next, you know, coming months.
Well, this has been a really illuminating conversation. I appreciate you all for taking the time to talk with us about this recall. I've been talking with Nicole Nixon, politics reporter for Cap Radio, Ivy Cargyle, assistant professor of political science at California State University, Bakersfield, and Ben Christopher, political reporter for Cal Matters. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kathleen. Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. While teaching a history course at Fresno State, Professor Ethan Keitel stumbled upon the forgotten history of a farm labor crisis in 1942 that inspired Fresno residents to leave their jobs and classrooms in order to work in the fields. Keitel, along with co-author Blaine Roberts, wrote about the crisis for the online magazine Boom California. I spoke with them about the conditions that led to this labor shortage.
The early 1940s were a very tumultuous time here in the Valley, as they were everywhere else, because, of course, World War II was going on. And so by the summer of 1942, the Valley faced a farm labor crisis. Partly this was because of the surge in demand for food during the war. But the other issue is that there was a real drain on the labor force itself because of the draft and because of higher paying jobs in factories in places like the Bay Area that paid pretty well. So there was already a labor shortage going on for these reasons. And then, of course, things got worse when President Roosevelt ordered the removal of all Japanese Americans. That was in February of 1942. Ultimately, the internment of Japanese Americans cost about 100,000 people their livelihoods and their freedom. And what's relevant for this labor shortage is that in that group were about 25 to 30,000 agricultural workers here in California. Some of these Japanese internees were farm owners, some were farm laborers. So the removal of Japanese Americans, in addition to being, you know, a really egregious violation of civil rights, contributed to an already bad labor crisis here in the Valley. Japanese Americans had picked grapes, olives, peaches, apricots, cotton, really a lot of things.
Ethan, give us a sense of the scope of the labor crisis. How bad was it?
It was pretty bad. I mean, the Fresno City, Fresno County, and the San Joaquin Valley really depended on agriculture and produced an extraordinary amount of agricultural goods. The cotton crop for the Valley, for instance, was valued in the early 1940s at $51 million. So that would be $800 million in money today. The grape crop, mostly raisin grapes, was valued at $30 million in their money. So this was tremendous. Tulare County and Fresno County, for instance, ranked second and third in the United States in terms of the value of their agricultural output. So they're producing an extraordinary amount of crops. This is worth a lot of money. And it's really valuable, not just to the farmers here and to the people who work for the farmers here and to the economy here in the Central Valley. It was valuable to the war effort. Cotton and grapes in particular, raisin grapes in particular, were used to feed the troops, to clothe the troops. And so they were, this was a crisis that spoke not just to the local economy, but to this national war effort.
Blaine, talk about how this crisis was managed. There was really a remarkable mobilization effort that you describe in the course of the article.
Sure. Well, there were a number of solutions and potential solutions that were proposed and presented by farmers and other agencies in the area. Farmers first asked permission to use Japanese internees to pick crops. Here in Fresno, for instance, there were about 10,000 Japanese Americans in two assembly centers. And so in the summer of 1942, Fresno farmers asked the military to be able to use them under armed guard to harvest their crops, particularly those grapes that needed to be picked.
So this was a prison labor force that they were asking for.
Essentially, yes, a captive prison labor force. And, you know, one of the things that's kind of interesting about this is that no one seemed to see the irony of asking to use Japanese internees to make up for a labor shortage that had been caused in part by the decision to intern them in the first place. Now, ultimately, the army, the military said no. It believed that Japanese internees were too dangerous. And what's interesting is that if you look through the pages of the Fresno Bee, you will see that many Valley residents agreed with this assessment. There are a lot of letters to the editor denouncing Japanese in virulently racist language, calling them disloyal and way, way worse. So after that, after the military said no, farmers had to seek out another labor source. And those were migrants from Mexico.
Right. I can pick up the story here. So the local farmers pivoted when the army said no, and they turned to the federal government. And here, the government was a little bit more cooperative in terms of bringing in migrant laborers from Mexico. That summer, the United States and Mexico negotiated an agreement that becomes known as the creation of a program known as the Bracero Program. So they put together this agreement in 1942. It's a program that will last several decades. It lasts until 1964. And over this long two-decade history, close to 5 million Mexican laborers, braceros, would come to the United States to work. Most of them would work in agriculture. But in 42, there's just a trickle that make it in. It takes a while for this to get negotiated. And all told, about 4,000 braceros come to the United States as a whole in 1942, and just 500 of those would make it to the San Joaquin Valley. So that's not going to really solve the labor crisis either. So they're looking around in the summer, and they start, and they think Japanese internment camp, internees, that doesn't work. Mexican braceros not going to work in the short term. And so they ultimately settle on civilian volunteers, on local Fresnans and folks who live in the larger valley.
There were a number of individuals and organizations who said, we need to try to motivate people who live here to volunteer to pick. So the governor of California was trying to get people to do this. Several federal government agencies, you had local school boards, the Fresno Chamber of Commerce, and even the Fresno Bee. Basically, we're all kind of big boosters for this idea that, you know, it can be our patriotic duty here to volunteer to go pick crops. And they really succeeded in motivating people to do this. One example, the main branch of Bank of America was in downtown Fresno, and they made arrangements for their employees to take off of work and go help pick grapes. So school buses carrying those employees, as well as housewives and workers from other local businesses, left from downtown each morning at about 6:30 for Vineyards and Reedley and Fowler and Kingsburg.
Maybe the most interesting component of this labor force, this volunteer labor force, which ultimately gets dubbed by the local newspaper, the Victory Harvest Army, was the local students. Some elementary school students, but really middle school and high school students. And to be honest, when I first read about this story, that's what piqued my interest, that it was students getting out from school. School districts completely suspended school, others just allowed students to volunteer. And ultimately, thousands upon thousands of Valley students would volunteer and pick the olives and the raisins, grapes, and the cotton and help save the crop.
And how compliant was the community when it came to responding to these calls to volunteer?
Well, from what we have gathered from looking through the Bee and other sources, it seems like this was a really big success. Just to give you one quick example, about 10,000 people, that was about 5% of Fresno County's population, picked grapes during the first 2 weeks of September 1942. That's just a 2 week period. And we do know that the value, the overall value of food and fiber produced in 1942 in Fresno County far exceeded what had been produced the year before. So in that respect, it was a real success and really a kind of model of community cooperation, cooperation between private interests and government entities. But it was also true that the Victory Harvest Army had some more negative kind of components to it. Another source of labor that local farmers used were vagrants, and they were essentially coerced into going out into the fields. The Fresno District Attorney ordered law enforcement officers to compel vagrants to go pick. And we also know that in various towns around the valley, officials targeted the incarcerated. So anyone who had been arrested for a minor infraction could have their jail term suspended if they agreed to work in the fields. But if they did not agree, they might receive more severe sentences than they otherwise would have. So there is an element of coercion to, you know, some people who participated in the Victory Harvest Army. And, you know, it kind of runs counter to the democratic ideals that the United States was fighting for during the war.
I'm curious what connections you have found between this farm labor crisis back in the 40s to the current debate around immigration and labor in agriculture.
Wow, that's a good question. And there's a lot of ways we could go with that. Certainly, one of the broader kind of conclusions we come to in this piece and our thinking about it is that the United States, but particularly, I think, out West, we don't pay enough attention to the role that the federal government and as a part of that, migrant laborers who are often brought in by the federal government through things like the Bracero program, the role that those played in the success of agriculture here. In many ways, the United States and the United States West was built by government intervention, government programs, many of them very negative programs, Indian removal programs, others certainly a more positive. Massive irrigation systems, damming, all of this was done by the federal government. And what we try to get at in this piece is that the federal government in the 1940s was also called upon by farmers to intervene and to help them. And I think we sort of lose a sense of that today, that the federal government's intervention in agriculture, intervention in the economy has been central to the success and the growth of the West.
Well, I've been talking with Ethan Keitel and Blaine Roberts, history professors at Fresno State and the authors of the article, Our Job is to Get It Picked, Volunteerism, Coercion, and the California Farm Labor Crisis of 1942. That article is available on the website Boom California. Blaine and Ethan, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Many of us think of hospitals as part of the safety net of our communities, but there's no guarantee they'll always be there. A new report estimates that California's hospitals have suffered billions in losses in the last year and could lose billions more before 2021 is through. Here with more on the pandemic's financial impact on hospitals is FM89's Carrie Klein with our weekly COVID-19 update. Carrie, welcome back.
Thanks, Kathleen.
First, as usual, let's begin with a status report across the valley.
Right. So once again, the numbers are looking really good. So fewer than 150 or so new cases are being reported every day in our 7-county area, and around 30 deaths are being reported every week. That death rate is still a little elevated, but we haven't seen case rates this low since before the very first surge last summer. Hospitals are looking good, too. They continue to empty out of COVID patients out of their general medical beds and ICUs. And according to the state reopening blueprint, the Valley continues to reopen, but slowly. Most counties in our area are in the orange tier under moderate risk levels, with only two counties, Merced and Madera, still in red. The level with the fewest restrictions is yellow. And then, of course, Governor Newsom teased that he plans for the state to lift all restrictions in mid-June, assuming we don't face another surge. Just over a million people in our area have gotten at least one vaccine dose, and that's a little over a third of our population.
What other vaccine news has come our way this week?
Well, one big piece of news is that kids are going to be eligible soon. So the FDA is anticipated to approve the Pfizer vaccine for 12 to 15-year-olds starting next week. But there is also some potential new urgency in the call for people to get vaccinated. The CDC just came out with a new report that models the pandemic for the next few months in the U.S., and it predicts a surge in early summer. Now, if vaccination rates ramp up and people continue to practice these basic safety precautions like social distancing and mask wearing, the surge could just be a bump. Or it could be more dramatic if people let down their guard and the virus continues to spread. Now, this is just a model, and so do with it what you will, but health officials in Fresno County, at least, are very concerned about a potential surge, and they're also very concerned about COVID variants, which are being detected locally in higher and higher numbers. And variants that are more severe and more contagious are partly what's being blamed for really tragic surges in India and other countries around the globe right now.
So as I mentioned earlier, a report released last week detailed some really extreme financial losses among the state's hospitals. What are some of these specifics of that report?
Right. So this was commissioned for an outside consulting company by the California Hospital Association, and it was based on survey data from hospitals around the state. And the key points are that hospital finances are looking really bad. Even after billions in aid from the federal government, California's hospitals still suffered losses in the last year, upwards of $8 billion. Now, that's not across the board. Some hospitals fared better than others, but the report estimates that nearly three quarters of hospitals either lost money in the last year or struggled to break even. And of course, the pandemic isn't over yet, and the forecast for 2021 is also dim. Here's California Hospital Association President Carmela Coyle in a media call about the report last week.
In 2019, 51% of California's hospitals, basically half of all California's hospitals, had barely sufficient margins. In 2020, that rose to 71% of California's hospitals with barely sufficient margins. And in 2021, they are estimating 55 to 60% of California's hospitals, now the majority, have barely sufficient operating margins.
Why is it so hard for hospitals to make money this year? I mean, at times, weren't they seeing record high numbers of patients?
Yeah, I had those questions too. And, you know, it turns out the answer has many parts. Of course, it's complicated. You know, to learn more, I spoke with Gary Herbst, the CEO of Cahuilla Delta Medical Center in Visalia. The bottom line for his hospital, he says, is that even after federal relief funding, the hospital ended up with operating losses last year of around $23 million. And in a typical year, they usually end with a profit around $15 million. So you can do the math on how big a downswing that was. One big reason was the loss of non-emergency procedures. For Cahuilla Health in particular, he says, you know, elective surgeries are really what sustains the hospital. And as we all likely remember, elective surgeries were canceled for many months. And even after they were brought back, patients have been reluctant to go back to hospitals. But there is also the cost of treating COVID patients. Herb said that in a 13-month period, the hospital discharged 2,500 COVID patients, which together incurred a loss of $12 million just right there.
Those patients primarily are suffering an acute respiratory distress, you know, condition. And that's not uncommon to have acute respiratory distress, particularly in elderly people during the winter season, pneumonia, other respiratory issues. They normally stay in the hospital about 5.5 days, but COVID patients stay 10, 12, 15 days on average. Some stay months. Some stay months on, you know, ventilators.
And he says an outsized number of patients in Tulare County are on public insurance, Medi-Cal and Medicare, which only pays a flat rate for each patient based on their condition. And so the hospital wasn't reimbursed at the rate that hospitals with more patients on commercial insurance would be.
Well, and then I would imagine there are also other factors like the need to increase staffing and to make building upgrades.
That's right. And in particular, traveling nurses were in huge demand, and they signed contracts anywhere from 2 to 5 times the hourly rate of staff nurses. Lots of employees were out in isolation at any given time, which meant remaining employees were working overtime and required more pay. Herbst says many of his employees also received bonuses for working overtime. Plus, he told me that Cahuilla Health upgraded the HVAC system in dozens of rooms and installed windows and exam room doors so that patients could communicate with doctors through them. There was the need for PPE, for COVID tests. All of this added up.
So what do these losses mean for hospitals? What have they needed to cut or change to make up for them?
Well, for Cahuilla Health, Herbst says not that much has changed yet. They did have to lay off a few dozen employees. But he says the hospital also had around $340 million in the bank, or about a half a year's worth of operating expenses.
And so we've been funding all these losses by essentially spending our cash reserves. But you can only spend them so far, and then you run the risk of defaulting on your debt because the bondholders expect you to have a certain amount of cash always on hand. So a lot of hospitals have dipped below that, but we haven't.
But on the other hand, other hospitals, you know, have had to lay off swaths of employees or furloughed them, or they've reduced their benefits. And administrators at other hospitals fear they won't be able to stay open at all in the long term.
What are advocates saying needs to be done to improve the financial outlook for hospitals?
Well, this is where Carmela Coyle of the California Hospital Association has a lot to say. You know, first off, she says they're hoping for additional stimulus funding from the federal government. Second, she says a bill making its way through the state legislature that would require bonuses for healthcare workers is well-intentioned but untenable and far too expensive. Plus, her organization is advocating for relief from a state law that requires hospitals to make seismic upgrades by 2030, which would cost upwards of $100 billion statewide.
Well, Carrie, thank you so much for this reporting.
Yeah, you're welcome, Kathleen.
And finally, it's time for another segment of StoryCorps San Joaquin, a series based on our collaboration with the personal history project StoryCorps. In this edited conversation from February's 2020 mobile tour in the Valley, 23-year-old Emily Farley interviews 75-year-old Eldania about her life as a male impersonator, entertaining in Fresno and beyond. And a warning to listeners, the conversation contains frank discussions about sex.
Can you describe your experience walking into your first gay bar?
Yes, it was 1965. I was 21 years old at the Red I went to the Red Robin, and I could not believe I was in such a place because most of my life I was kind of, you know, I didn't know there were bars, and there were so many gay people that is the first place I made friends and quickly learned the Red Robin held drag shows. My soul just lit up inside of me. The very first performance I did was La Bamba by Richie Valle. The audience, by their applause, I knew I had their approval, and I was hooked.
So what are some different, like, characters you've embodied through the years?
You mean entertaining?
Yeah.
Tom Jones, Julio Iglesias, Frank Sinatra, Tony Bennett. I have performed through the Imperial Court. I would perform in San Francisco, the Bay Area, L.A., Baltimore. And I have a lot of fun memories from the 60s to the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Yeah. And for me, being the only male impersonator, I was among all these drag queens, you know?
Yeah.
And I felt, I mean, most of them were beautiful. I felt lucky. I said, oh my God, all these women, you know?
Yeah.
And you know what? It also helped me pick up girls at when I would entertain.
I bet it did.
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever meet any lovers doing this?
Oh, well, yeah. But I was the type of person that I would be discreet. Because I've even picked up married women in the grocery store. There's a lot of horny housewives out there, I'll tell you that. But, you know, but I was discreet. And I, you know, whether you believe this or not, but there's no reason for me to lie about it. But I've had three women in my lifetime tell me, if I could jar your sex, I'd be a millionaire. We got so well known that gays from L.A. and San Francisco, when they knew we had a show at the Girl of the Golden West, we would pack them in, you know. After the show, we go to breakfast. There was a place right there on Olive and 99 called Tiny's. The waitresses, they loved us because we come in there and like 20 of us, and we have breakfast and we have a good time. And then they make good tips off of us, too. So it was fun. We had clean fun. You know, we did. It was, we drank, you know, some of us got real drunk, but we looked out for each other and it was a good time. And, you know, and then, like I said, you know, like between 2 and 4 in the morning, we'd go home and sleep, you know, and then go to work. Sometimes, oh my God, I would go to work hungover so bad. It was pretty rough, you know, but.
Yeah. So how does it feel when you perform?
Oh, wow. I feed my soul.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really do. I feed my soul and I'm in my own world. Mm-hmm. I get into character. I make sure my lip sync is tight, you know, that I don't forget my words. I when I'm entertaining, I'm that person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I do Tom Jones, you know, I'm Tom Jones. If I do Julio Iglesias, I'm Julio Iglesias. It hasn't been easy for me.
Yeah.
But yet at the same time, you know, it's been good in many ways. And I would like to, I hope I'm sure there's a lot of young women out there that would like to entertain. But
yeah.
It's scary for them.
Yeah.
It was scary for me at first.
Yeah.
But you have to just try. You have to go for it and try,
yeah.
You know, and just be brave.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll either succeed or not. But it all depends on you to do it.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing with me.
Well, thank you for listening. And I hope I did something right by doing this.
Of course.
You know.
And
I don't know how much longer I have to live because I'm 75, but I wish I could entertain another 20 years, but I can't.
Yeah.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2022 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvineawards.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.